So what if you can't touch the sky? It doesn't mean you shouldn't try. Do you wanna fly?
Joining us on Jibber Jabber Podcast today is the producer of High Times, the mega talented Carolyn McKidd. Carolyn Kidd. Why did I say McKidd?
Oh, McKidd.
You've got McCall in the head.
Did we speak to someone that was McKidd recently?
Kevin McKidd.
Kevin McKidd. We've never even spoken to him, but he's the only McKidd I know.
I'm keeping this in. Apologies.
It's actually Carolyn Sinclair.
I told my
family name and just give all the credit to my
right. See, I told J Mac that before the show, and he was like, "I think it's just McKidd," and that's why McKidd's in my head.
This is what happens. This is what happens. Kevin likes to shift blame around. So thanks for that, mate.
Brilliant. So we've spoken to quite a few of the cast so far, and all have had so much to say about you, Carolyn. All the best stuff that you can imagine. One thing that we heard from John Rooney, and I'll just get this out of the way right now, is that when you had a meeting with him about, I think it was between doing the short film and making the series, he said that you positioned him in your office so that he had a deck above his head. He said, "I found she was awfully specific." I was like, "Okay." You kind of shed some light on that.
Oh, I do vaguely remember doing this, to be honest, but it can get a bit boring in the offices, so you've got to do what you can to make yourself short. Also, meeting with a brand new writer that you've never worked with before. Penis sticking out the top of his head makes the meeting a bit more fun.
you were well suited to High Times.
Talking about that, I mean, he was on the show and he was just kind of, he walked us through in the way he does his storytelling, and he was like, and I went in and here's me, and I was quite nervous, and Carolyn wanted to speak to me, and I sat down and she was like, "Can you just move over to the left of it?" And he was like, "I was thinking, God, she's quite specific."
Totally forgotten about that.
That's the beauty of this show.
We hear that a lot. Yeah, we hear that a lot.
Grassing me up.
Oh, but yeah, he kind of walked us through in a good 2-hour long episode, which was, and you can basically hear he goes from the start to the kind of where it kind of went down. And he basically, everybody we spoke to said how good you were, Justin. And there's Davey as well. I mean, they say that you guys are just as important to that family as everybody else. Obviously, you don't see you guys on screen, but you guys were there making it happen. So for the listeners who are not familiar with who you are because they've not seen you on the screen, can you kind of tell them what your job was for High Times and how you kind of you were kind of the glue that made all the pieces stick together?
Yeah, well, I'm the producer, so I don't think anybody really knows what a producer does. So can you each tell me two things that a producer does?
It's everything.
It's funding. Funding.
Yeah.
Funding? Okay, yeah, fine. Yeah, anything else?
Assistance with casting, maybe?
Yeah! Okay. See, nobody really knows what producers do. Producers actually, I mean, I teach entire day classes telling people what producers do, so I could bore you for hours and hours on that, but wow. I'll try and be succinct about it. So a producer's like a magician, and you sit at your desk and you've got nothing to make, not a thing, and you as a producer have basically got to produce a rabbit out of a hat. You've got to produce a show that an audience is going to watch and like and love, and you've got to get it out there and distributed. So you start off by trying to find a project. So a book that you might like, you go to the theatre, you look for writers that you like, you ask writers to send you scripts, you speak to agents, all of that. That's your first thing that you do. Then you work with the writer that you've commissioned on their script. So you work really closely on the script writing. So a producer works with a script editor, and the script editor gives the notes to the writer. But that's basically so that the producer and the writer can maintain a good relationship. Yeah. So the producer doesn't have to say to the writer, oh, I really hate what you've done with scene three. You really need to change it and do this because the writer will be, fuck you. And then it'll just be awful. So the producer speaks to the script editor about what they think. And then together with the script editor, they come up with a set of notes and the script editor works with the writer. But the producer is really, really hands-on in the script writing. Right. And I'm really happy to say that for High Times because the scripts were totally brilliant. Sometimes some things that I've done with the scripts aren't so brilliant. Nothing to do with me. Nothing. so you do that and then you cast it. You choose the directors. You're responsible for hiring the crew with your line producer. You cast it. You're very, very hands-on in the casting. You're not just assisting in the casting. I mean, I actually sat down and thought, who do I want to be in this? And I didn't even work with a casting director, actually. I just cast it myself. So wow. I did that. None of the directors did that. The directors were just brought on when everything was already in place. So then I brought on the directors, and then you have to build a team around you to sort of work on the scheduling and all of that day-to-day running of the shoot. I mean, this was such a low budget production that I was there every day on set, really hands on. Then you go to the edit and you look at all the edits and you speak to the editor. That's not working. You need to try this. You need to do that. I'm also having to talk to the people that have given me the money, STV, to make sure they're all happy. And then I've got to do the sound design. And then I've got to, you know, loads to do.
There's so you are the glue then. You kind of do what I do on the podcast, right? Kind of.
I think you kind of do what she does, Kevin.
Aye, sorry.
So, well, why do you think the director gets top billing above the producer then? The producer seems to do so much more than a director, really.
Well, they don't really get top billing. It's just that I think the French auteurs in the 60s made directors the gods of visual work, didn't they? I mean, mostly in cinema. I have to say, in television, it's mostly the writers that are the gods, and the directors are really just hired hands, especially in America. The writers are absolutely the gods. But the producers do get top billing. If you look at the credits on a TV show, the producer gets the final card on their own, usually.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know that main Oscar that's given out for best film?
Yeah.
The final one, the one that everyone waits for, that's given to the producers.
We know that John Rooney actually has the BAFTA and he says, you're not getting it.
I know. But I'm such a lovely person. I said he could keep it.
He told us, he was like, Callum was like, he's still got that BAFTA on his head. I am keeping it.
He can have it.
It's got your name on it as well, though, anyway. So,
High Times was very much his idea. I mean, it really wouldn't have happened without John. It was absolutely his idea, and it came from a short film, Blackout, that he'd made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd seen the short film. I'd been brought into STV when I was very pregnant, actually, and asked to come up with a new series for them. I was just tasked with finding a series. It's like your dream job, isn't it?
Yeah, wow.
I did that. I watched a lot of short films. I really loved Blackout, and I thought, oh my God, that actually would be the best.
Yes.
Of all, wouldn't it, Blackout?
What stood out about it for you? I mean, we've seen that ourselves.
Yeah.
And I was pissing myself at so many different parts, right? But for us, what we loved about Blackout and High Times is how real and raw to the bone it is. It's a really hilarious series, but yet there's so much depth in it as well. You can relate to at least one character, but you know every other character. You know someone like them in your life. What was it that stood out for you about Blackout that made you go, right, do you know what, this, opposed to everything else I've seen, this is the one I'm going to make like High Times a series from?
Well, first of all, it's exactly what you say. It's relatable characters. I mean, I thought the characters were incredibly relatable and real and believable, but also warm and funny. Mm-hmm. But I could see the potential for storylines for them. And also, actually, in terms of the budget we had in High Times, because it was tiny, we had a titchy, tiny budget. So I had to be looking for a TV series that could be filmed really, really cheaply. Mm-hmm. So I wanted something that would play well in one location. And so I was like, okay, there we go, one location, we've got the one high-rise flat. Mm-hmm. So that if I can go out and find one great high-rise flat just to film the whole thing in, then we don't have to do expensive set builds and we don't have to hire studios. Mm-hmm. We can just go and actually shoot it in a block of flats and keep it feeling really authentic and really genuine. So it was a combination. First of all, it's the character, and then it's the story, and then it's like, yeah, that setting would work on this budget that we've got as well. So it was all three of those things.
Oh.
And I love John's sense of humour. Like, he made me laugh.
Yeah.
Even during the episode we did with him, he managed to kind of reel us in. Like little fish telling us stories that weren't true just so we'd go, really? And he's like, no, I'm fucking making it up. he's really good at spinning a yarn.
Yeah. He can really pull you in. When you're talking about, you pretty much were cast, and then for yourself, how would you say that you visualize the characters? You already kind of seen them in blackout. So at that point then, was it just a case of recasting the guys that were already cast?
Well, I can't quite remember who was in blackout, but it was Stephen and Alan, wasn't it?
Yeah. And Paul as well.
Paul as well, mm-hmm. Right, as a different character.
He was never named. He was never really named, Jimmy.
But yeah. to me, that was Jimmy moving in and his pal helping him and fucking it up.
I mean, in terms of Stephen and Alan, like, nobody else could have played them. It had to be them. And I'm not the kind of producer that wants to sort of put, you know, my own... I don't want to start again and make it mine. Yeah. I totally believe in, if something's not broken, then don't fix it. Is that a phrase?
That's it. You got it perfectly.
Yeah.
We're known for screwing a phrase or two up, or a name.
Yeah, like Kevin earlier on said, quite raw to the bone, which I'm pretty sure is completely made up.
Raw to the bone, I like
it.
Mate, I don't copy. I'm not in the game of plagiarising. I create my own content, thanks, J-Mac.
You're welcome. You know.
So anyway, I thought Stephen and Alan, it has to be them, they're perfect. Paul's obviously a very fine actor, so there needed to be a role for him as well. And mm-hmm. then everyone else, when you're reading the script, you just sort of imagine what they look like in your head. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a picture in your head of who they are, and then you just, you know, we did casting sessions to try and find Tracy.
Yes.
Is she called Tracy? I just had a total mind.
Yeah, the teenager.
No, that's Tracy, yeah.
So we did a big sort of casting session to try and find her, but John Morrison, for example. Mm-hmm. I loved John Morrison from old Peter McDougall TV shows.
Right, yeah.
When I was a kid, I used to watch John Morrison on my telly and go, oh my God, I really want to meet that man. So when a part became available for him, I just got in touch with his agent and I'm like, please, would you come and play this role for us?
Yeah.
And he did. So
that's quite the feat when you want something to happen, you just kind of will it into existence.
John had a lot of fond things to say about working on the show, and the first thing he said to this wasn't even on the podcast, this was on a kind of initial phone call that I had with him. He described you as, excuse his language, I quote, fucking brilliant. So when he said that, he said the same about John's writing, the exact same. I won't say it again, don't have to, but he had a lot of respect for what you did on the show. I mean, bringing John into that, obviously that seems like you're quite excited about the fact that John's coming in.
Oh my God, I was so excited. I'm getting so excited I can't speak. But I had to go and meet him for the first time when he came into the studios, and phone call comes up, Caroline, John Morrison's in reception for you. My heart was like beating out of my cage because, you know, when I was about 10 years old, I'd wanted to marry John Morrison. So it was like, oh my God. Oh my
so
God.
Did I. No.
So I went down to reception, like, sweaty top lip, you know, nervous and excited. And yeah, I was just very, very overjoyed that you agreed to take part. It doesn't take long to get over that sort of initial stage, I suppose, of I don't know what it is. nervous. Yeah. And like, oh my God, he's going to hate me. He's not going to want to do it. I'm going to totally blow it.
Oh, it's kind of amazing, that feeling, though, because when we started doing a podcast, say, 2 years ago, we didn't get to meet a lot of actors and actresses. And over the last 2 years, we've kind of met a lot of people that we regarded as heroes. And it's amazing, like, how quickly you do go from fanboy girl to just, oh, this is kind of what we're doing now, you know? And was that your first time kind of having that with someone, or had you previously worked with people that you really idolized?
I'd had it previously when I had to interview Jarvis Cocker for a job. I absolutely loved Jarvis Cocker. He was my absolute, you know, musical hero.
He's just common people.
Oh, I missed a phone call from Sean Connery once.
Oh, no way.
I had asked Sean Connery to play God in The Acid House, the film that I made with Irvin Welsh. Have you seen that?
Yeah, no, but it's on my...
A long time ago for me. I seen it maybe when I was 17, 18.
Stephen McCall's in that.
Yeah, that's when I first worked with Stephen. So I knew Stephen already, because that was pre-High Times. That was before so yeah, when I phoned, no I didn't, I was at Kirsty Wark's company and they knew where he lived in Spain. So I wrote Sean Connery a letter saying, please will you play God in my thing I'm doing with Irvin Welsh. And one day I was late for work, and when I got into work, one of the assistants said, oh, Carolyn, you just missed Sean Connery, just came for you. I was like, oh no, I didn't get to speak to him.
God.
Unfortunate, but hey, you know what? Look at all the things you did do from that point on. So you can't really dwell on that.
And I got to work with Maurice Reeves as God, and he's
nice.
He's very good.
You've done, obviously, looking at your other kind of projects that you've worked on, even like up until this day, you're still doing it by the looks of it. you've done a lot of, you've produced a lot of short films. Is that how Blackout came onto your radar? Was it because of your kind of fondness for short films, or was it a coincidence?
No, not a coincidence, because I was making short films. I think I made a short film on the same scheme as Blackout. So I would have been along at a screening where they screened all of the films made on the scheme at the same time. And I'd have seen it then. I really love short films. I just think it's a fantastic way to sort of seed new talent. And I've just recently, about 2 months ago, stopped working for the Scottish Film Talent Network. And we were funded by the BFI and Scottish Screen for the past 6 years to find new and emerging screenwriting, directing, producing talent. And so I've made about 50 short films in the past 7 years as an executive producer, basically just dishing out the money and working on scripts and all of that and finding the talent. And I just absolutely love that. I mean, it's so satisfying. And we were also developing feature scripts as well. And one of our first feature scripts is coming out. It's been made by Film 4. It's called Limbo, and that's going to be released in the cinemas, I think, soon after lockdown.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I love working with new talent. Absolutely love working with new talent. And that's what I did on High Times. It was really all new directing talent that I was working with. Like, all those directors that I worked with, like Davey Mackay, Justin Malotnikoff, James Henry. I regret there was no women, actually. I feel really bad about that. And nowadays, if I was doing that now, there's no way I wouldn't have a woman in the mix. But
maybe you were enough women for all of them.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, it's a show that, I mean, it doesn't pander to a male or female audience. Mm-hmm. You know, there's stuff in that show for absolutely everybody. So you're right. A female director could easily have taken the helm on.
It's just warm and human and funny, isn't it? But all of these guys that worked on it, they'd only really done short films before that, so they'd come to my attention via their great work they'd done on short films. And then after High Times, I know that Justin went off to have an amazing, and James Henry went off to have amazing careers in high-end TV drama. They went, unfortunately, away down to London to do big, huge budget drama shows. It did a good job for those directors.
Why does all the money seem to go down to London? Even like when an actor makes it in Scotland, their next move is to go to London. That seems to be the done thing.
I know, it's such a shame, isn't it? I just think there's a feeling that Scotland's too small and everybody wants to appeal to the world or to the nation of the UK, I suppose.
Mm. I mean, occasionally you'll get that actor who kind of really stands out, but really does kind of. I mean, I don't know where he lives now, actually, but Martin Compston, for example, he hit it big time. I mean, after Sweet 16, obviously it was made by Ken Loach. Sorry, it was directed by Ken Loach. It was made by the producer.
Yeah, you're doing the director thing.
You've learned a lot.
I'm getting there already. Look at that. I mean, he's definitely kind of broken the boundary. He's now he's a proper star. Mm-hmm. But that happens so rarely for Scottish people. The last time I've seen that happen was probably Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
You've got James McAvoy.
Sorry.
Butler. Come on, laddie.
Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler.
Yeah.
Mark Bonner. Mark Bonner. Mark Bonner. I mean, they're big.
Yes, people. Yes. He's really good.
Yeah.
He was in the Elton John biopic as well.
Yeah.
Did you happen to catch the short story that John had written with, I think he'd written it, and Stephen McCall actually directed it, and it's called Electric Blues?
I did see that.
Yeah. That's something else, right? It's that doctor, you know. Hello!
Kneeling in your pencil, eh?
So silly. See, when that guy came on screen, I actually screamed throughout my house laughing. It was just so over the top. But, you know, and one thing I really liked about it is I could tell it was written by John Rooney. It has that John Rooney thing to it, right? Yeah. Just something about the way it writes.
He wrote a thing to be performed in a pub, and it was just called Cunt.
Yes, we heard about that from John Morrison.
Yeah. An interesting title, given that.
A bit of writing. I actually feel that title did a disservice to the writing because it makes you feel it's not going to be good writing, but it is.
Probably, yeah. Mm. Probably the only detriment to it.
So, do you ever have that kind of situation where you get presented with a script or something and the title just makes you go, nah, I'm not touching it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All the time. Titles are really hard to come by. Really, really hard to come by. But you know, there was a time when I was doing development at STV, and it was just about the time when TV screens, they have, like, you know, 20 channels on the one screen and tiny little lines that tell you what the program's about. So your title has to be super catchy. So we would have these development meetings and we were basically asked to come up with a title, not a program idea. And if somebody would come up with a great title, then we would think about what the idea would be for the program.
Wow.
Isn't that terrible?
That's madness.
So that's about the time when on Channel 5 you had shows like The Boy with a Testicle instead of a Nose.
See, that's where we were going to go with that there. Yeah. See, if I was sitting in that development meeting, I'd just be sitting there going, interesting.
Yeah, I remember Jo Brand made a joke about that on a panel show once. She was like, next on Channel 5 tonight, The Boy with a Face Like a Baboon's Arse. And that's how crazy the titles were, The Boy with a Tree for a Face.
And that's because we were asked to come up with titles, and if you got a good title, you'd get to work on your idea.
And so you had these ideas already there, but you just had to have a good title for that idea? Or it was like, just throw something and if it sticks, we'll build a show around it?
I mean, to be honest, I was making High Times, so I didn't really take part in the meetings. I sat in the meetings, but I didn't have ideas.
Were you working, at the time you were working on High Times, were you juggling other projects at the same time? Or was it just all your focus was on that until it was finished?
Well, actually, all my focus was on High Times when we were making it, like 100%. All day, every day, really late nights, you know, 5 and 6 days a week. Whereas nowadays, I juggle 4 or 5 different projects at the same time. So I'm not quite sure how I do it now. Maybe because I just didn't know what I was doing back then. I needed more time to sort of figure it all out, perhaps. I did have a child that I was breastfeeding. I was constantly squeezing milk out my boobs as well at the same time. So that was quite tiring. So yeah, I was only focusing on the one show.
Oh wow!
So what a show to focus on.
Yeah.
So you have to secure funding then for the projects that you work on. How hard was it then to kind of get funding for High Times? And is it usually hard to get funding, or do you find that it depends how you deliver the pitch, or is it you just walk in and say, "Here's what I need," and they give it to you?
Well, it wasn't hard on High Times because I'd been brought into STV to specifically find a show.
That's right, yeah.
I just had a chat with my fantastic exec producer at the time, Eric Coulter, who now makes like Shetland and Bodyguard.
All right.
Eric's a top guy, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So he was my exec, just the loveliest man ever to work for. So I just said to him, I really want to make this show, High Times, what do you think? And he was like, yeah, looks great, let's make it. So that was it. And the money was there. STV had the money because they'd stopped making Take the High Road, which was their soap opera.
Mate, that was some theme song to that. I like the theme song for that.
Can't remember it. I don't think I ever
It's playing it. In my head right now.
Kevin, I can't remember it and I'm older than you. What's going on?
Mate, I'm always being musical. And it's like, nee, nee, nee,
nee, nee, nee. Oh, that's it.
Editing that bit out now again. That's the one. Right?
So that come to an end, so they had the money for that and they just put that into High Times basically. What a different day in shows.
So I take it, was Take the High Road kind of filmed on a similar budget to that then?
It probably had a little bit more.
That's what I was thinking.
It must have had a bit more because it was a way out in Loss, wasn't it? And then the studio and it must have had more.
Yeah.
So they'll have taken some of the money away for something else and then given us the leftovers.
Tuck it in another wee corner somewhere for something else.
See, on that kind of note, do you think had they given them the full whack from Take the High Road and maybe even a bit more, do you think the show could have produced? I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong. Like from what you guys were working with to what you've produced was unbelievable. Like, I think it's perfect. I wouldn't even give you the extra money, right? But but do you think there could have been more potential with more money?
No, do you know what? I'm a massive believer in good TV drama and comedy comes from story and character. Mm-hmm. And you can shoot it on your iPhone or a Fisher Price Pixel camera. And if the story and the characters are good, it'll be good.
Right.
Like my husband, who I love dearly, works on lots of really big, big budget Netflix shows. Some of them are great. Some of them have got a big budget and
no substance.
So I just think you can spend millions and millions of pounds on SFX and VFX and fancy cameras and all the lights and cranes and gadgets in the world. And if the story's not right, then
you know
that, rubbish.
That's my biggest bugbear with modern cinema. Everybody just wants to release the next big action or superhero film, whereas I don't know if it might be an age thing because I'm getting. Not getting old, getting a wee bit older, but I'd sit and watch A Few Good Men 50 times before watching a Marvel film, and it's something that's a bit of a lost art now. Is making a film that's all about the story and character. All the films now are just about how good it looks on the screen, and there's something wrong with that. It's a bad formula.
I totally agree. I absolutely hate overblown production values. At the expense of story and character. So, no, I don't think we could have made it any better. I mean, we shot it on really shitty cameras with very few lights in tiny little cramped locations. And we didn't have that much time for design or costume, or we didn't have that much time to shoot it. We had to shoot it all really quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think the script was so good and the actors were so brilliant and the characters were so strong that none of that mattered.
One thing a couple of the actors that we've spoken to so far have said is that they actually got rehearsal time for this show, which is something that's not too common with kind of TV shows, and certainly TV shows with that kind of budget. And they're of the opinion that rehearsal time made a big difference in the final product, despite the lack of funding.
Yeah, well, I didn't want the performances to look like they were just kind of dialed in. I think sometimes on soap operas don't get any rehearsal time at all, do they? I think sometimes on soap operas, they're really just saying the lines because they don't have time to work through the emotions of the lines or whatever. So, I don't know, rehearsal always feels really important to me. I would never scrimp on rehearsal.
Yeah, so that was something you implemented then, was the rehearsal time?
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's just because they have
Producers do everything.
That's a t-shirt, right?
We're just going to edit. We'll edit the whole show and just put your face on every character now.
That's so, but when you were on the set, which you were there all the time then, I know John was there from time to time, and we've asked this question a few times to several people, and from the cast to yourself, and they've all said either a funny story or they've gone, oh, do you know what? It was that long ago, I can't remember. To which I think they're just hiding stuff. But do you have any really funny stories or just things that stood out to you on set from when you were filming over the two series?
There's probably a couple of things that stick in my head, and I should just tell you what they are because these are the ones that stick in my head and I don't really know why, but one of them isn't that funny. In fact, it's not funny at all, but on our first day of filming, because we were filming in the old flats in Dalmarnock in Glasgow, mm-hmm. that have now been knocked down, and actually I was told at the time that the land around there was unsuitable to be built on because of some old ironwork factories or something. But anyway, now there's loads of eco houses on the land. So, anyway, we were filming in the flats, and the only people living in the flats at the time we were filming were heroin addicts because they cleared everything else out. And on the very first day, I went into the lift, and it had been fine during prep, but I think we'd sort of maybe alerted everyone to our presence on our first day of filming because there was, you know, a catering truck and a couple of bigger vans and stuff. So we were in the lift going up to, I can't remember what floor we were on, maybe the 10th floor to film. So we're on the lift going up, and a guy in the lift told me that if I didn't give him 50 quid every day we were filming, he would stab me with his knee dirty needles.
What?
Hell. Jesus Christ, man.
I know. So that was a little bit on the first day. So I didn't know how am I going to deal with this? So I did a sort of two-pronged approach on that because we were invading their space, right? So I felt bad for doing that. That's where they live. This is their home and everything. So I had a two-pronged attack. I asked them to come and join us at lunch and offered them food off the truck if they wanted it, which they didn't really want anyway because they didn't eat much. And I upped the security.
We heard, I think John had said that there were gangsters, and then you guys did put more security on. But God, how many stabbings did you take?
I never actually got hurt once. And that same guy that had approached me in the lift on day one, by the end of week two, he did come over to the catering truck and chat to us all at lunchtime. So there's
a story itself. There's a short story. Yeah. And then here's a name. I'll pitch it. Guy threatens to stab woman, then shares a lunch. Like, what the hell?
There's a Channel 5 doc waiting in the wings.
That's a great title. And then the other thing that sticks in my head is in season two, we were filming the big party scene. And I'd got quite a lot of my pals to come and fill up the scene because they come sort of for fun and expenses and stuff. Oh, I probably shouldn't say that.
That's where the budget went.
But my friends were all really camp, so it was meant to be this kind of hard party, and then my friends are all incredibly camp, so it made the party. If you look really closely, it looks like maybe it's, I don't know, it looks like a really camp party. Nice. Mostly at all the men at the party.
To be fair, I mean, we spent
I'm going to watch that with new eyes, honestly.
For sure, but the way it's kind of shot, though, like the you are kind of focusing on the story that's going on anyway. You tend not to notice what's going on around. So in a good way, that's kind of, you kind of forget about that kind of thing. But we'd never noticed that. So I mean, that's, I'm going to check it out again.
That was a really, really busy day, right? We had a lot to get through because when you've got loads of people, it just takes so much longer to do anything. And Justin Malotnikoff was the director that day, and he was coming through from Edinburgh, and he turned up about 4 hours late because he got stuck behind a truck that spilled out pig lard on the motorway.
What an excuse. What an excuse.
Couldn't he make it up?
Call bullshit right now.
It was actually true because I thought, I'm like that. Yeah, right. But it was true. It was in the news. So we had to just start filming that without the director. We had to just get on with it. The first AD just got on with starting to film the party scene because we didn't have the money to run over. So we just had to get on with it.
Oh, well, that's
those are my two, those are the two things that stick in my head. It's just sort of general feeling of loveliness, because it was just such a love.
When you received the script for High Times, once John had written it, was there anything in there that you were like, that's definitely not going to happen? I mean, because we've read the Amsterdam script, and when we were looking through that, there was a few things I was like, that would not fly today at all. Was there anything back then that you were like, John, we need to speak about this part?
About what in the Amsterdam script did you think?
I would say the I don't know, the gimp mask with the dildo on it. Stuff like that. It's actually, I've said it on every podcast, but I'm going to say it again because it's still one of the funniest lines I've ever read, and I wish I could see it on screen. Was the guy's having a heart attack? He's in full S&M bondage regalia, and he's got this gimp mask on with a dildo where the nose should be. And then Rab and Jake go to take it off to make sure he can breathe. And then Jake says to Rab, imagine we took this off and his nose was that shape. And every... I can't even say it without laughing.
I think that was such
a good line. Well,
I don't think that would be an issue. I think more the dialogue between
I think it's the type of thing that could give it that horrible 11 p.m. on a Tuesday time slot.
Yeah. I think you've got to be careful nowadays with representations of women, perhaps in a way that 15 years ago when we made High Times, it wasn't quite, we weren't quite so on the ball about it then, but, and much to my shame, but I think now we have to be a bit more careful about that.
I don't think there's any kind of, just in my opinion, there's no kind of negative female stereotypes that I can think of. I mean, you've got the whole Janet having an affair with Tex and stuff, but you can see her reasoning for it. I mean, she's married to basically me. so you can totally see, like, the first time, like, we binge watched it so many times now because it's one of these, it's got a layered kind of humor to it where you miss things the first time and you'll catch it the second time. And I've watched it probably four times, maybe Kevin, maybe six or seven now, but the second time I watched it, I wasn't thinking, Janet, you're a bitch anymore. You're kind of on her side. And like Tracy was probably a pretty accurate representation of a teenager at the time and probably still now, though they won't admit it.
You think now you'd be able to have that hint at that sort of relationship between Stephen and Tracy, though, because there's quite an age gap there, isn't there?
Yeah, but yeah, the good thing about it is Stephen's character, Rab,
never acted on it until she was
very much aware of what she was. And to say, right, put yourself in Rab's shoes, and there's a girl who you get on great with. There's clearly a friendship bond there, and you're attracted to her. She's virgin and legal. It's a natural human thing to probably feel that way. So he acknowledges that the part with the Scrabble and it's Kitty Fiddler is playing on his mind. That's a very natural thing. And for that to be on screen and someone to relate to that, to go, you know what, I was in, not me, but someone may have been it.
15 years ago, right? I mean, I still think personally that is hilarious. But I think that the world's changed, and I don't think you could do a kiddie fiddler joke now.
Nah, I mean, you could take that out, fair enough.
But it would offend the kiddie fiddlers, and we can't have that.
No. Kiddie fiddlers' lives matter.
Jesus Christ, they went there.
But I just think that the relationship, though, that whole hinted thing, that, and it becomes something. You know, in real life, I can't imagine that there aren't relationships that kind of start out that way, where someone, a guy or a woman, knows someone who's a bit younger than them, maybe not legal, they wait a couple of years, and then the spark was always there, but now the timing's right. I mean, I think it's the whole thing where if you're a teacher and you fall for a student, right, that's terrible because you're a teacher, you've got influence over their mind. But what if you're a teacher that taught a student, you're now no longer a teacher or even in that school, the student's grown up, you meet in different circumstances. Is that any wrong? Do you know what I mean?
Well, they explored that
in real life.
Remember that?
And what? I've never heard of
that.
Oh,
yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. that's gone.
At the time, I think that was a really brilliant storyline, and I absolutely loved that storyline. But I think we'd have to play it a little bit differently now. I think that was my point. Mm. But I don't know if you know about compliance. Have you heard about compliance? I'll try not to be too boring.
In my kind of work, compliance means there's a team and they're looking into you.
Right. So when you make any TV show, you've got a compliance officer. So there was a compliance officer at STV. And when I work with the BBC, you know, I have to fill in these big compliance forms. And it's actually one of my favourite parts of the job. Basically got to list every naughty thing that's in your programme. So at 1 minute and 2 seconds, fuck you, you wanker. And then justify why it's been said. And then at 3 minutes, you know, so-and-so punches so-and-so on the nose and kicks him in the balls. He does this because you've got to justify it, right? So with High Times, because the scripts were a little bit, you know, edgy and pushing the boundaries a bit, with the hash smoking and the pedophilia and all of that. No, that wasn't in there.
Absolutely not.
They were kind of a bit edgy. So I actually worked with the compliance officer at STV in advance. So she would read all the scripts and we would have chats about the things that she felt weren't acceptable. Yeah. And she was an amazing woman, a great sense of humour. I totally loved her. And they were my favourite conversations, was to sit with her and talk through the script about what was and wasn't acceptable. And one of the things that she said absolutely wasn't acceptable and we had to remove it from the script was the bit where Stephen's rolling the joint on the Bible.
Oh, right. Okay.
Did that get removed? Because that's so...
No.
So she said, you absolutely can't have that. You cannot have that because the most complaints we ever get from viewers is to do with religion. So, you know, God's name with a swear word or as a swear word and anything to do with religion in the Bible, we always get loads of complaints. So you absolutely can't have it. But I really loved it, and I was like, oh no, but can't we find a compromise? Surely there's something we can do to allow us still to have that. And she suggested, well, why don't you have another character just say, oh, you can't do that. You can't roll a joint on the Bible. And that will be the voice of the audience watching.
Yeah. You'll go to hell. I'm in hell already.
that's a really clever workaround. See, that's the thing that makes, that's the thing that almost makes that so ridiculous, is that one character saying something means, oh, it's fine now.
Yeah.
It kind of makes you go, well, why was it not fine to start with?
If you watch this, it's just people being indignant and getting upset. Uh-huh. Meaning they can't have that because you know,
just turn it off. I don't like this.
Well, can't have people switching it off. Yeah, that loses money.
Yeah. But Al, I think it's Stephen's role in the joint on the Bible in the scene, isn't it? And then Alex,
yeah.
So that was it. That was all we needed to do. So those were my favourite kind of conversations. I didn't find anything John wrote undoable. I mean, I wanted to push it as much as I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
Have you got that kind of wee wild side as well, where you're like, yeah, let's...
Oh, I'm an old punk.
She loved Jarvis Cocker.
Well, that was in the 90s. That was... I'm a lot older, yeah. Back in the...
So when the BAFTA came around then and you guys won, I take it for you being the producer, the jack of all trades, the woman wearing many hats, for you that must have felt like... yes, my work has been recognised, and also it would have been a really good team. I mean, it would have been for you guys, I imagine it felt like a family getting that nod of approval. Do you remember where you were when you told you were going to win it, or was it there? I think John said he knew he was winning it.
Wow, I had no idea, and I was sitting next to John.
Yeah.
We were all just sitting at the table, and it was being announced by Lorraine Kelly.
That's right.
She's all mumsy and pumpable, as they say.
Lovely. And it was really nice because STV had actually paid for quite a lot of us, because you got to buy your BAFTA seats. So paid for quite a lot of us to be there. So, you know, even our production designer, Ursula Cleary, a really brilliant production designer, she got a seat as well. And James Henry was there, and David Mackay, the couple of, you know, it was really great. There was a lot of us there. So it just felt, I can't remember what we're up against. Definitely Taggart. Every year, and something else, maybe Still Game or something weird like that. Anyway, it was amazing because I didn't think we were going to win, because we were a really tiny, low budget. I can't tell you how tiny our budget was. Like, has anyone told you about that?
I think it was like just under 50k an episode.
It was a little bit more than 50k, so it was about 70, right? But to put that into perspective, at the time we had 70k. And at the same time, Taggart had about 850k.
For an episode?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
What the... Jesus Christ.
So that's the difference in, you know, budget levels.
Is this?
So to be at the BAFTAs and beat the big budget guys, that was like, yeah.
It just goes to show you that substance over grandeur is really, it's what we need. It's what we want. And
Taggart was really brilliant, but I think that the BAFTA jury just felt that we were felt like a breath of fresh air or something, because nobody was doing what we were doing. Nobody was making gritty, raw, funny stuff.
They obviously watched it. I mean, that's why you guys won it, because they watched it. You know, I mean, I say that to anybody that would ever question how good that show is. Just watch it, you know. It does it all itself for you. I don't need to tell you how good it is. Just watch it.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, it's still right. Love it.
this has been the first kind of, it's the first TV show for me. I mean, people recommend TV shows all the time now, especially with streaming being on the go. It's like, oh, you need to watch Breaking Bad. You need to watch Mindhunter. You need to watch this. You need to watch that. And I'm like, okay. And then I start them and I'm like, it's awful fucking slow. Mm-hmm. And then I get fed up quite quickly. But High Times is the first TV show in literally 10 years that I actually got excited about seeing the next. And it's a wee comedy drama in Glasgow. Yeah. You know, I can't believe how much an effect it actually had on me. I mean, I think kind of speaking to Stephen, like we had no, sorry, I'll rephrase that. I had no idea that High Times was even a thing up until we spoke to Stephen McCall the first time. He came to my house. And we sat down and did an interview. And he mentioned High Times briefly, and we just kind of skipped over it. And then I looked at it afterwards, and I was like, Kevin, you need to watch this High Times. It's fucking excellent. And it's like, why have I never heard of it? Kevin remembers an advert for it.
That's right.
On TV when he was young. I didn't even remember that. And to find 12 episodes of gold that I never knew existed, I felt like I'd hit the mother load. And it's an absolute testament to you and everybody that was involved in it. It's a triumph, and I feel it should, although it had the BAFTA, I think it should still have a little bit more recognition and a little bit more of a kind of role to play in the zeitgeist of
what's going on. That's very kind. I mean, it played on STV Glasgow over and over and over and over again, but you wouldn't have thought that.
No, see when it first initially came out, I was still quite young, obviously, right? And
a wee baby bye.
Right, so we didn't have Sky that you could record, believe it or not, right? You couldn't record it. And I'd seen that advert that'd come on, because I used to quote it to my pals. And it's when Tex and Stephen, Tex and Rab, you know, he's like, keep a change, and he's like, can I be too careful? And he's like, oh, is that right? I change. And that had me howling. And I was what? What age would I have been there? Early teens, like, if not 12, early teens. And I always remembered that. So see, when Jordan had said, I've gone ahead, and this was after we met with Stephen, he goes, I went back and watched High Times. And I'm like, High Times, that rings a bell, because I looked for it back then and I couldn't find it. And that's why I never saw it the first time around.
It was funny though, because I'd said to you as well, you told me about that scene and I was like, yep. Stephen, who was here at my house, was in that scene. You're like, shut up.
Like, what? I can remember there was characters. I just wouldn't, you know, I could never have picked out a lineup. But when he said that was Stephen, I was like, no way. For me, it was just like stars aligned. I was like, I need to go now. I know that where it exists, right?
Did you watch it for the first time, like, pretty recently?
Yeah, yep. Basically, start of this year. But I was aware of it way back when. I just couldn't find it.
Old-fashioned.
No. See, this we keep getting asked this.
We've been asked that before. Yeah.
No, it lives right up to today, and I think, see, if you were to make a season 3 tomorrow, then
see that little wry smile.
It would fit just right back in, because we've also said to people, and people we know have watched it the first time round, but when we had Stephen come back on the show via Skype during lockdown, because the last time we'd met, we said to our audience, you know, Stephen's coming back on, anybody got questions? And after that first time, people went and checked out High Times, came back to us and were like, please ask them, why was there only two seasons? What happened? Where was the continuation of High Times? Why did it stop there? This was the most asked questions we were getting. So we put it to Stephen, and that's kind of how we got moving forward with this, because everybody involved really, really wished there was more. And it's always just been the case where it's a case of circumstance, budget, maybe it was wrong time, maybe it was made for the wrong people. There's all different viewpoints to it. But everybody right now said if the crystal ball was here and the stars could align, then they would all jump at doing High Times again. And they all, and every time we say, here's who we're speaking to this week, everybody that we're messaging back and forth is like, oh, please send my love. Please, they're so nice. Like, everybody sends their love to you as well. They know that we're speaking to you tonight. And it's just such a nice thing to be part of from outside looking in.
I think that we got in there at a really good time just before STV sort of didn't have the money to do that kind of thing anymore. Yeah. They made Elizabeth Is Missing recently, didn't they? But they made that with money. So they didn't make that with their own money. But this was sort of the last of making things with their own money. Mm. And then that organisation just changed completely.
So you don't necessarily think it was a High Times issue then? It was more on STV and High Times got caught in the whirlpool then?
100% wasn't a High Times issue. They loved High Times. If you read the board notes from their board meetings, like they're raving about High Times. It was absolutely just lack of money. Right. So I don't really have a bad word to say about them because, you know, Eric is my exec there, really was the most phenomenal boss to work with. He really supported everything we wanted to do and helped us get some quite edgy content through, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they just ran out of money. There's not an endless pot.
Just talking about the issue of, like, the question you asked us, does it feel dated? Something that Judith Williams brought up with us was the fact that there's not a lot of diversity in characters when it comes to ethnicity and things like that. Now, that is 100% true. but I think that, again, that could be explained away by lack of budget as well. You could only keep it so... It was such a tight show. There was only, what, four households basically involved in the whole thing. You couldn't venture away from the flats. You know, it was all stuck in there. And I think that now, if it was given the kind of proper treatment, it would be easy to correct that. I don't want to say mistake, because at the time it wouldn't have been a mistake. It was an oversight, really. But now they could easily get around that, and I think actually make it even an even fuller show than it already was.
I mean, Tex was quite tanned. Fake tan, maybe.
I completely agree with that. And it was diverse in terms of the amount of women in it. I think it was 50-50, wasn't it? Which is unusual for Scottish comedy, which is usually very white and very male. it was good in those terms, but it definitely could have been more ethnically diverse. I mean, it was something John Rooney and I discussed. I don't know if he spoke to you about it, but it wasn't something that he really felt he could do properly. So we decided just to leave it.
Right.
Because I didn't want to force him to tackle something that he didn't feel comfortable tackling.
Yeah.
And anyway, I think that now, 15 years later, Glasgow is a much more ethnically diverse place. I mean, I work in Film City in Govan, and in the 8 years that I've been driving from the west end of Glasgow through to Film City, through Govan, Govan's changed beyond all recognition. It used to be, you know, just completely white, and now it's completely not white. There's only a couple of old white guys stoating about Govan, and it's become this much more vibrant, you know, more community-minded kind of place, and the kids queuing outside the school there are from all ethnicities, because of course Glasgow's, I think, the second biggest receiver of asylum seekers and refugees in the UK, second only to London. So the makeup of Glasgow has changed a lot in the past 15 years, and so I think that now, were we to make High Times, we would be definitely wrong not to include a non-white family.
Yeah. That sounds pretty much spot on to me. And you know, it's not even out with the realms of possibility at this point. This is a show that, again, I'll give you that wee smile that Kevin does, could be brought back, right? And I think were it to be brought back with the same or almost the same team as before, it could easily start really kind of ripping the arse off the TV ratings charts. The realism of it on top of the humor. The good thing about the humor in it is it's not slapstick or silly. It's humor that we all say things like that every day to everybody in our lives, and that's what makes it special. It's not, this isn't gags with people kind of hanging off rooftops by the kind of back of their trousers and help, help. This is just the way.
Sorry, that was funny. Help, help.
It's the way people talk to each other. And actually, I was speaking to a guy that lives just around the corner from me here, and he reminds me, I won't tell him this to his face, but he reminds me so much of Jake that it's fucking ridiculous. Down to he's got a wee smile that's just like Jake's. He's got that kind of low voice, that quiet voice, just like Jake. And I just don't have the heart to tell him that he reminds me of this stoner idiot.
What I liked about Jake is he had that wee soft thing, but now and then Rab would pick him and be like, "Oh, well done, you got sacked now." And he's like, "At least I've got a job." It's just he would bark like a wee dog and then go back down to just being a puppy again.
That bit where that sequence where they fell out over over Rab shagging what was her name?
I can't
remember. Her real name's Angie. What's her character name? Ruth. Angie Ruth.
Martin. Yes.
Yeah, right. But that moment, you actually felt a bit sad. I was like, that's like me falling out with Kevin now. I couldn't. We bicker every now and again. We'll bicker about something. And it tends to be over misconstrued text messages, because that's how everybody falls out these days.
He leaves me on red half the time, and I'm like, oh, flamethrower out. You don't leave me on red, motherfucker.
And you really care about the characters, you feel for them, and it's just, again, I'll say it again, it's a testament to how well the show was made.
I think that relationship between Rab and Jake was set up brilliantly well in that first episode, where Rab is, you know, trying to coach Jake and what to say at his job interview and all that. But actually, he just doesn't want him to get the job.
Yeah.
He's going to be lonely and he's going to miss him.
Yeah.
I think that's your sort of save the cat moment, isn't it? Where you introduce a character with something that you really love about them, and I think that what you loved about Rab there was his attachment to his friend Jake.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Do you how do you think High Times would hold up now? So say tomorrow there's released series 3 of High Times. Where do you think the characters and all that would be? Where would you like to see the characters?
I often wonder about where Rab and Jake would be now, actually, because. Mm-hmm. I've just started working with Channel X, who make Detectress and Home, and Channel X and Hopscotch, we've started a comedy company. So I've been thinking, would Rab, something with Rab and Jake? Where would they be now? I don't know. I think they might be too old to be funny now.
I disagree with that completely. I think they're still
going. Have you spoken to Stephen recently?
If they were in the same place, if they were still living with each other.
I think there'd have to be a bridge here from where the last episode ended. So we know that Jimmy had gone with Claire and Chloe. So there's where Rab's at. I imagine the first episode of season 3 would be, you know, Rab trying to reconnect with his daughter that he's thought of for years, and maybe he's had a bit of a falling out with Jake. So he goes to Amsterdam to find him, maybe, right? Before he goes to meet his daughter, right? Something like that.
Right?
And then, oh, hey, I could never. John Rooney. Well, I think if we planted seeds and said, John, what do you think
about this? Off air. Jesus Christ.
Do you know, but I've...
Well, because his daughter would be 15 now, right? She'd be a double teenager, so that would be brilliant.
Right, and, you know, I think that amount of time, I mean, the first time we saw Rab really being a grown-up and taking responsibility was when he admitted to himself and his daughter in that insanely amazing scene where he's breaking his heart and he lets her go. But I think that's probably ate him up. And there comes a point where he's like, do you know what? No, now is the time. Because you kind of saw hints of that in season 2, where he did want to kind of clean himself up a bit and be like, do you know what? There is more. Because he's not an idiot. He's a stoner, but he's very intelligent. He's intelligent. But I think there could probably be a bit of I would imagine seeing it from Rab's point of view. It starts with Rab, and the series would probably build to bringing back the cast. Do you know what I mean? Like, you would start off following Rab. He goes to Amsterdam to meet Jake. That's where Jake went to open up a cafe or something. Gets with Jake. They decide, you know what, we'll go back to the... And they've got some idea to start a radio station or something, right? They go back with this pipe dream idea. And then he's like, you know, what I really need is... And he breaks... This is where you see the more human side, the more grown-up side to Rab. Talks about how he wonders what his daughter's like. And then, you know, through that, they go looking for... Claire and Jimmy, and of course you're going to have Alice and Eddie. They're going to be there because they were going to follow him down to Manchester. Reintroducing these characters. Jimmy's there, right?
The thing that makes all these things so much more possible, especially nowadays, is social media. You get these guys jump on social media; they can find anybody they want.
I know, it's so true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Social media.
Scary.
Is like scary, but it's also really difficult to put into a drama. Like, I know a lot of writers that go, I'm actually going to set this in the 80s because I cannot cope with Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and all that.
Like, I think it's very easy. It's just a communication tool. If you look at it as a communication tool, a quick shot of Rab looking at his phone, searching his daughter's name to find an image where it's almost that jailbait Tracy thing, and he doesn't even realise he's actually looking at his daughter. Ah, that'd be a scene. Right?
Obviously, there's the wee legal issues to work around, like they need to like Facetagram or Instabook, you know? But it makes the possibility of the characters reconnecting a lot more kind of likely. But like you said, if it's something that writers aren't too keen on
but just a couple of writers. I mean, I'm sure most writers handle it.
I don't think I missed anybody out there. That would seriously, when you look at Rab connecting with Chloe, that brings all the cast together then, because Rab and Jake were already friends. Yeah, you've got. I said this to Cora, and she liked the idea, and it was that, you know how Janet and Janet and Frank had split up. You never quite got to see them get together. You always felt like they were going to get back together, but the show just never got that long. And I kind of thought to myself how I'd like to see it play out as so Tracy probably could be with Rab, right? Because they did kind of, and that could be that relationship that stayed. But Tracy's having some sort of shindig, or maybe Rab and Tracy get engaged, and this is the first time where Janet and Frank see each other for like how long, 10 years, right? Because they moved off to do their own thing, but they've still kept equally with Tracy. And then because Anthony Strachan's lost a lot of weight, she sees the man that she wanted back in series one, and they start to rekindle.
Yeah.
How cool would that be, right?
And now he knows she wants an orgasm.
So. No, right.
I didn't know you wanted one.
when I'm describing High Times to someone, and I'm like, you need to watch it. It's great. It's Scottish humour. That's all that I go to. Between that and the whole, where's your interview? Where's your interview shirt with the ash stains and the burns? Is like, oh, it needs ironed. That's always what sells it. It has a room laughing, just quoting it. And again, I've said to John, I've said to everybody, I think where the world's at right now, and this kind of, everything's so tense and everybody's ready to fight over something. It would be really nice to have a TV show like that again, a nice Scottish rooted TV show that makes you just sit back and enjoy somebody else's issues for once.
Do you find comedy, you mentioned that you were part of this new kind of project with comedy recently, and do you find comedy a hard thing to navigate now for fear of offending people?
I think it's just got a whole lot more difficult. I'm not very good in this terrain, I don't think, because I'm from a generation where you did offend people for humorous gain.
Yeah. No one died from being offended, right?
No,
I didn't. Just got on with our day.
So, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it is a bit more difficult. But I mean, I'm really interested in fully rounded human beings who happen to be funny in my comedy drama. I'm not. I don't like the stuff you were talking about not liking as well. The kind of broad, one dimensional, slapsticky or physical people falling over, all that stuff. Not interested in that. So
yeah.
I think as long as you're doing fully rounded human beings, say stupid stuff, and as long as you have a character that acknowledges that stupid stuff, then as long as you're aware.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I mean, if you get somebody that says something that's a bit off colour, you'd be like, mate, you can't fucking say that.
That's a get out line, right?
Yeah, that's something that I'll definitely be taking forward.
But it's really you've got to be really careful, haven't you? I think because we have got to get better at stuff. But I have to say I felt really sad that the Fawlty Towers Nazi episode was removed. You know, don't mention the Nazis.
I've got a DVD. Never removed it from me.
The BBC is sort of. I don't know if it's even the BBC. I don't know the details, but something happened to that episode recently, and I thought, oh no! But the whole thing about that is that Basil Fawlty is being inappropriate, and we, the audience, know that he's being inappropriate and that he shouldn't be saying that, and that's where the humour comes from. Yeah. It isn't.
If there's one group of people that you should be able to take the piss out of, it should be the Nazis at this point.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Don't take the piss out of insert here. But
German. I mean, maybe it was just felt it was anti-German, which, you know. But the point is that all the other characters knew he shouldn't be doing that, and that it was anti-German. He himself knew. Don't mention the don't mention. So I don't really understand that one. I don't understand that one at all.
It's unfortunate, the kind of way that things are going. I think if you can recognise something as comedy, and that it's a mirror to society, if you can't recognise that, it's not like if you were to write a character, as John actually shed some light on this, if a character's bigoted, should he not be bigoted just because it's going to offend someone? Like, that's their character. These people exist. People exist. And in order to kind of create something that's going to be real, you kind of have to have real elements, and that's just the way of it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I always say, and I've said this to anybody in my life, that that's too this, cool, turn it off. You don't have to go after the guys that create it. Turn it off.
don't watch Channel 4 after 9:30 at night. Just don't. You're going to be somebody's going to be offended by something, and the point is, it's like everything else in life. How many other times in life do you say, well, you can't please everybody? It should be like that with TV. You can't please everybody. You just need to accept it. Yeah. And I don't know, I could be showing my privilege there, you know, but
we have to be mindful about all of the sort of big problems of the day that we perhaps take as much consideration of in the past. I think we really do have to. I mean, I want to live in a society where we're all equal and we all love each other and we all get on and there's no division and we're all equal. And so I'd like to make sure that the work I make ultimately reflects that, I suppose. Even if characters, you know, I want that bigot to get their comeuppance, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, let them say the worst things. Let the audience hear the worst things, but at least let them see him getting a kicking. that's not even allowed anymore. You can't even put certain words out there now. And I think it's just putting far too much a stranglehold on how good content could actually be.
I find with a character like a bigot or something that you continuously build as this asshole, I think the most powerful thing you could do is show the human side to them. Because that makes you step back and go, wait a minute. So all this hate I have for someone is because of something, and you create then understanding. And when you can understand something and take away that whole me versus you kind of thing, you can kind of get to somewhere. And I think that's where you would need that to move further on in society. So there is game the kicking, but also kind of give a bit of backstory as to why he's like that. Kind of show the human side. What kind of stuff is he going through as well? And then give him a good kicking. Because you're not getting away with it just because you had a shitty dad.
Comedy can be a really powerful tool, can't it? Because you can sneak in some good messaging in the guise of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's what, again, if the show was to come back tomorrow, it could easily tackle some of these issues. There's no way this absolute gem couldn't come back and shine again. But anyway, this is our life task just now, isn't it? we want to bring High Times back, and even if it's the old episodes, they get some more recognition. But we'd love to see it come back to the forefront, just to show how good Scottish TV can be. Because I think Scottish TV is 100 if not 200% overlooked when it comes to the entire media from the UK. I think Scottish TV has got a lot to offer.
Absolutely.
Hey! I agree.
Yeah. So you would like to see it come back?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely. Now that you've told me that it could all centre around Rab and meeting his 15-year-old daughter, I feel quite excited about it.
See, there you go. You're not the only one that said that. John Rooney has he's like a rocket right now.
Yeah. I haven't seen John in a while, actually. I need to get him out for a pint when... Well, I can do that now, can't I?
Yeah, well, hey...
Yeah, we're nearly there, aye. We just need to book an appointment. Booking an appointment at a fucking beer garden. Where are we?
How did I get here? You
know, my niece earlier on was talking about... she's going out for her friend's 19th birthday, and they've booked a two-hour slot in a beer garden. It's like two hours, like... By the time that 2 hours is done, you want to go out and get wrecked. But you just can't. Just end up going home and, I don't know, drinking whatever's in the cupboard. So, yeah, but it's getting all you guys together for a drink. That sounds like a fucking party to me.
Yeah, one that people should be able to buy tickets for to make sure these guys are all well compensated for. And you can bring all your cool merchandise and have it signed by the cast and crew, right?
You're so subtle, Kevin.
That has definitely been something that everybody's been up for, as the High Times reunion, which the one thing that everybody keeps saying that they'd love about it is to see everybody again, because you guys have all went off and had different careers, different paths. And one thing we got from everybody, absolutely everybody, is the fact that, you know, yous are all still close, even if yous are not so regular, the whole kind of thing where you... might not see each other for 2 years, but when you do see each other, it's like nothing's changed. Yeah. You know, and that's one thing we get. And your name, Davey's name. I mean, we've spoke to quite a lot of the cast already now, but every time we mention another name for the show, everybody's face lights up, and you guys just have this real fondness for each other, which is great because we see that in the show. You know,
we should recreate our rap party. We actually had the best rap party ever. Yeah. You know, at the end of filming, you have a party, and I usually find them really kind of, oh God, like, do we have to pat ourselves on the back just because we managed to finish heat, like, we've not saved children from famine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but our rap party on High Times was one of the most fun nights I'd ever had. We had a fancy dress karaoke night, and everyone came dressed up, and we all sang songs and danced to one another. It was just absolutely brilliant.
Oh, I want to be there right now.
And Stephen came as Pablo Escobar.
Do you know what I've found as well? The cast of High Times are all very talented when it comes to music. Stephen's a DJ. You've got Cora. She's a hell of a singer.
Yeah.
Right.
Judith.
She's in a great band, Cora. Yeah.
I mean, and then there's Paul McCall, who's probably not done as much recently, but even for the show.
Well, Paul sang the
that's
end.
That's right.
Paul singing the songs at the end.
Yeah. And did you have quite a say in that being part of the show as for the credits and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was a show that had a lot of different directors, he's one person that's got an overall view of what the thing is. So that got to be me on that show, which is why I loved it so much.
Yeah.
So, you know, the opening title sequence, that James shot that, and I knew that I wanted to have music that sounded a bit like the Moldy Peaches, because I really loved the Moldy Peaches.
Yeah.
I couldn't afford to license the Moldy Peaches, so we hired somebody, and I was like, I really love this Moldy Peaches kind of really rough sound, like you've recorded it in your bedroom.
You said that. Kevin said that to me before.
So that was a creative decision made by a producer. Who would have thought?
Yeah, you guys don't get enough credit. There's an Oscar for Best Producer.
But it's Best Film. That goes to the producer, right?
Yeah, but we don't know that. That's the thing. The general public don't know that. We just think it's because the film was so good.
Nobody knows what producer. I go and teach film students in their final year, and their students... you know, who maybe some of them want to be producers. They still don't have a clue. They think it's all about budgeting. It's all about finance and budgeting. Bollocks. Yeah. That's a tiny, minute part.
Right. So it's almost like raising a child.
Yeah.
For however long it's of its existence. Yeah.
Bring it into existence and then nurture it and look after it and send it out into the world.
Do whatever you need to do to make it survive.
That's it.
See, that's what a producer is, guys. Absolutely.
Well, this has been a great conversation, Carlin. Thanks very much for giving us your time. I know it's a Friday night. This is normally where everybody's out, but still, can't you really do it yet? So it's been an absolute blast. I hope you listen to the episodes that we've done already. There's a lot of good stuff there with the actors and actresses that we've had so far. And yeah, there's a lot more to come.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
No, it's been a hell of a pleasure for us. Do you have anywhere you'd like people to follow your social media, or do you kind of fly under the radar and just keep your head down?
I'm a bit of a flying under the radar kind of a person.
I found that to be the case. When I was trying to search you, I was like, where is she?
I don't even have a LinkedIn. I like to keep it all a bit private, so I don't really exist. But check out my daughter's band, The Ninth Wave.
Yeah, I'll actually.
I've got her on the screen right now. She looks a lot like you. Yeah, I can see it. Unless I'm looking at somebody different.
Share screen.
I don't even know.
He's not. He doesn't know how to push. Hang on. You have no idea.
I am so bad with computers. It's not even funny.
It says share screen.
I've got mute, stop video.
He's just hiding all his porn windows. Screen. He's like, I can't find it. Shit.
Oh no, look, host disabled participant screen sharing. It's Kevin, you stop me from doing this.
Oh, I don't know how to fix that.
I'll show you what I'll take a picture and I'll send it to you.
You took a photograph, a Polaroid.
a wee Polaroid.
Put it on chat, can't you?
Aye. If your daughter gives permission, we can play one of her songs at the end of this episode so that people that may want to check her out can hear the music.
Play, Used to Be Yours.
Used to Be Yours.
Yeah,
coming up right now, Used to Be Yours.
I think we played that one Made in Chelsea.
Ah, nice. Oh, that's good then.
Class. I just want to check. Your daughter's got blonde hair, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
That's the right one. See, she does look.